I think we'd like to begin our second panel. I hope that you are all able to rifle through the cupboards of the faculty club for more Hume. I hope that we will soon be accessioning more Hume as of later on today. In any case, I'd like to start our second panel. The second panel today is called Remembering Raymond Klebanski. I would now like to introduce Isabelle Robitaille, responsable de la collection patrimoniale de livres anciens à la Bibliothèque et Archives nationales du Québec, as the moderator of this panel.
Thank you, Anne-Marie. I'm really honored this afternoon to be able to present you the three speakers on this panel entitled Remembering Raymond Klebanski. They will provide us with a personal appreciation of both the man himself and his interaction with libraries. So each speaker will have about 20 minutes, and then after that we'll have a period of questions. Our first speaker is Professor Georges Leroux. He's an emeritus professor in philosophy at the Université du Québec à Montréal, where he taught Greek philosophy from 1969 to 2006. He's the creator of for the beautiful exhibit presently held at the Grande Bibliothèque, Raymond Klebanski, La Bibliothèque d'un philosophe. He will present us personal souvenirs about Dr. Klebanski. Monsieur Leroux.
Oh, hello to everyone. I'm very pleased and honored to have this wonderful occasion to recall all my souvenirs about Raymond Klebanski. Of course, a few minutes are not enough to encompass even a slight overview of his personality and contribution to scholarship. But I'll do my best. Raymond Klebanski was a scholar of great reputation. It is very difficult to say in what field exactly, because he contributed to so many areas of knowledge and research. Of course, he was a scholar in medieval and Renaissance studies, and also in early modern thought. He was also, for several generations of students, like myself, a model of humanistic studies, engaged in an unceasing dialogue with the history of art, literature, and science. His work was immense, as we can easily grasp from a very quick look at his bibliography. In this very short presentation, I will recall first a few moments of his life, and then concentrate on some souvenirs of my experience as his student and fellow classicist. Let us start with a few biographical elements. Raymond Klebanski was born in Paris on October the 15th, 1905, son of a Jewish family from Frankfurt. He was brought up in two languages, German and French. His primary school was in the 10th arrondissement in Paris, where he seems to have been a pupil with excellent marks in all literary matters. His father, Hermann Klebanski, was a wine merchant and therefore based in Paris, and was often all away traveling for his business. He had a younger sister, Sonia. In August 1914, the declaration of war forced the family to move back to Germany, and young Raymond was first a student in the Goethe-Gymnasium in Frankfurt, a top-class high school where he studied classics. The education he was offered there was traditional and somewhat authoritarian. For the most part, it centered on literature, with an important program of Greek, Latin, history, and German poetry. In his memoirs, he recalls that the school was respectuous of his Jewish students who were not forced to be in school for examinations on Saturdays. In 1920, when he was 15, surprisingly, that would be a question for his to be biographer, he asked his father to register in the Odenwaldschule, a libertarian school founded by a psychologist and humanist, now in every encyclopedia of education. His name was Paul Geheb. Highly considered by writers and intellectuals like Thomas Mann and Ernst Cassirer, who had their children schooled there, Odenwald favored a liberal and humanistic approach to education. The motto of the school was the famous verse of Pindar from the Second Olympics, "Become who you are." We can read the personal remarks of Paul Geheb written on the report card of the young Klibanski, which was preserved and is actually in the exhibition. According to that report card, Raymond was undoubtedly a highly gifted pupil. Weimar culture was centered on the knowledge of German poetry and philosophy. Hölderlin, Rilke, Goethe, Hegel, and Schelling, but also the main Greek and Roman philosophers and writers, from Plato to Epictetus. These were the background of his Bildung. In his memoirs, Raymond Klibanski remembers very fondly this pedagogy of freedom, which was felt by the students as a strong countermodel to the authoritarian trend of Imperial Germany. In 1923, at age 18, Raymond Klibanski began his university years in Heidelberg, where he registered in philosophy, a city that was to remain, as he wrote, the intellectual and spiritual heart of all his life. It was then, at the peak of Weimar culture, and many, many major figures of philosophy and literature were among his teachers. For example, the philosopher Heinrich Rickert, specialist of Kant, and Karl Jaspers, whom he befriended. Both were his professors in philosophy, and both were for him models of Republican ideals, away from the Kulturpessimismus of the early fascist thinkers that were already at work in those years. The philosophical spectrum during those early years of his formation was very open, and young Klibanski does not seem to owe much to the Kantism of Rickert, nor to the existential psychology, Leben's philosophy, so-called, of Karl Jaspers. He did not engage in research work with Karl Jaspers, which we could have thought. Jaspers remained for him the figure of freedom, freedom of thought, freedom of conscience. But Klibanski never favored what we began to call later existentialism. We see from his report card, also preserved, that he was in the class of Ludwig Curtius and also the great, great philologist Otto Regenbogen, two major figures of German philology who guided him and confirmed his decision towards classical scholarship. At what date exactly did he decide to embark upon that? We do not really know. After Jaspers had recommended him for a fellowship in Kiel, northern Germany, Klibanski went to study there under the guidance of sociologist Ferdinand Tönnies, a sociologist renowned for his work on community. He was there in 1924. He was the author of a book called Society and Community, and at that time an academic star. But Raymond Klibanski did not stay long with him and came back to Heidelberg to resume doctoral studies under the supervision of philosopher and classic scholar Ernst Hoffmann. I would venture to say that this figure, Hoffmann, would deserve precise study. He was such an important figure, but today he is nearly forgotten. As a student of Jaspers, Klibanski was mostly interested in the doctrine of freedom, as I said, its concrete nature. The notion of Dasein, the idea of responsibility towards history, Jaspers was the main proponent of a concrete doctrine of freedom. But then, as Klibanski was to be forced himself to concede, if I might say so, Jaspers was forced to leave the University of Heidelberg because his wife, Gertrud Mayer, was Jewish. We have a photograph, very moving, I would love to show it to you. In 1986, the university, the Senate of Heidelberg University, held a ceremony to rehabilitate his Jewish professors. And we can read, it's the haphazard of alphabetical order, the names of Jaspers and Klibanski together on that list, on the marble plate affixed for that occasion. Klibanski was forced, like Jaspers, to leave. We know very little of the conversations of Jaspers and Klibanski. For a short time, 1931-1933, after Klibanski had been named Privatdozent, that is, first professor in the university, they were both on the staff of the philosophy faculty. Jaspers was also interested in the history of philosophy, that's sure. It was he who introduced the famous theory of the actual period for Greek philosophy, where he linked the progressive development of philosophy and religion. That theory is not really represented in Klibanski's work, but it was important at that time. The education of Raymond Klibanski, his Bildungsroman, was dominated, as I said, by great Heidelberg figures whom he could meet on a daily basis. Those were times of animated discussions on political matters and the future of German culture in its fragile republic. The optimistic scheme of Hegelian philosophy was no longer possible. Who could pretend to dictate the course of history? What was the responsibility of the intellectual? Even if he was never a disciple of the great poet Stefan George, whose influence was then at its zenith, Klibanski acknowledged his importance as a literary icon and a model of human values. But he could not join in the circle of the friends of George and remain critical of his romantic nostalgia that many now blame for flirting with pre-fascist ideology. In the exhibition, of course, we have many splendid editions of George's books that are part of Klibanski's collection. Indeed, Stefan George promoted a new Reich based on a mixture of spiritual values and political utopia, and his lyrical poetry was read by many as ambiguous in the rise of National Socialism. Who was this charismatic leader, self-designed as a Führer, bound to guide the German people? George himself, for sure, taught the young Klibanski. He wrote that. Heidelberg was far away from Berlin. Not much of critical theory or Marxist thought or even psychoanalysis had any influence there. It was a very remote space. Jaspers remained a very sober figure, and it took him some time to understand the limitations of Heidelberg culture, and that was the case also for young Klibanski. Among the friends of Klibanski during this study period, we must mention a few names, all important. First, Walter Solmitz, a man that he was to meet again later in Hamburg when both were students of Ernst Cassirer. And then also Karl Wolfskehl, a great poet, very near the Stefan George circle, who was forced to exile in Australia. Both were Jewish, both were forced to immigration. De Grace's name in his Heidelberg environment was, of course, Hannah Arendt. She was also a student of Jaspers in those years, and her doctoral dissertation on St. Augustine was written during those years. But Klibanski did not have a very high opinion of her, and they were never friends. Mrs. Marianne Weber, widow of the sociologist Max Weber, greeted Klibanski in her Heidelberg home and did much to help him join in literary and philosophical salons, which were numerous in Heidelberg. There is something to say on the influence of the Weberian critique of subjectivity on the young Klibanski, who never forgot about the ideal of objectivity in the human sciences and politics. He often quoted the argument in favor of the neutrality of science and the critique of personal charisma and convictions. If a new, non-Hegelian philosophy of culture was to emerge, taught the young Klibanski, it would have to be on the lines drawn by Weber, respectful of history, rational, and with an opening for diversity. This Weberian experience can somewhat be considered as the first sign of Klibanski's later endeavors towards tolerance and freedom. He was notoriously precocious, a fact acknowledged by his early masters, Karl Jaspers and Ernst Cassirer. Who else, listen to this, and think of it when you have brilliant students, who else could have gained the support of Cassirer for an edition of an otherwise unknown text of the early Renaissance to be included in the Festschrift prepared by Cassirer to honor his master Abbey Warburg in 1927. The young man, young Klibanski, who had just arrived in Hamburg at the age of 21, on leave from Heidelberg, did just that. In a period of no more than a few months, he was able to complete a full recognitio of the manuscripts of the French humanist Charles de Beauvel, his Liber de Sabiente, Book of the Wise. How was that possible? This is still an enigma for me. Cassirer must have been stunned, shocked, when he read this piece of superb scholarship, the first publication of Raymond Klibanski, 1927. Raymond Klibanski's first publication is then his edition, Editio Critica, of the De Sapienti. This French master knew very well the work of Nicholas of Cusa, for whom he got his inspiration to write his great work on the place of man in the world. Drawing from the theme of microcosm, macrocosm, represented in many fashions in the art of the Renaissance, most in Dürer and Leonardo da Vinci, for example, in the representation of the system of planets and the discussion on temperaments, Beauvel presents an image of man as the mirror of the universe in which we can see the motto of Klibanski's works. Pierced, I quote, pierced with all sorts of arrows and radiations of specific forms and norms emanating from the world. End of quotation. This intermediary being becomes a polymorphous creature. One can recognize here easily the doctrine of influence, temperaments, melancholy, which was to interest Klibanski later. Beauvel writes a hymn to the perfection of human nature, sublime, perfect in its rationality, the very nexus of every being in the world. How did Klibanski, age 21, start working on this until then unedited text? Had it been discussed in the Heidelberg seminar of Hoffmann on Nicholas of Cusa, it might be the case. It seems highly improbable, at least to me, that he would have completed this work during his year in Hamburg. But the invitation of Cassirer retains all its importance. It informs us of the deep intellectual friendship and shared perspectives at this early phase of Klibanski's research. It is this interest in the place of man in culture that gives its main impulse to the project of a new edition of the works of Nicholas of Cusa that was to require Klibanski until the war and after. For the most part, then, his work, his research, had reached its maturity while he was still in Germany, before he was forced to flee the Nazi regime because of his Jewish origins. It is indeed hard to believe that such a young scholar could gain this exceptional reputation in such a short period. The fact is that not only Cassira, but also Panofsky and Saxel were admirative of his talent and had no better wish than to work with this young man. The study on Saturn and melancholy prepared during those years after the 1923 book of Panofsky, but published only in 1964 because of the war, is just another example of the magnificent scholarship that grew out of Klibanski's Weimar years. After the war, when he set residence here in Montreal, his work resumed its pace, although it was of a different nature. The experience of war had influenced him deeply, and Klibanski, at the age of 40, embarked upon a whole new intellectual adventure that we can sum up as a humanistic commitment towards peace and toleration. Thus he turned to modern liberal thinkers such as John Locke and David Hume, who kept him busy until his later years. But that did not mean that he left aside his work on Nicholas of Cusa or Meister Eckhart. His bibliography proves just the opposite. He maintained a rhythm of publication that enabled him to carry on the program elaborated during his youth. And I have not even mentioned his bigger project, the Corpus Platonicum Medii Evi, a monumental enterprise put up to revise the until then unilateral vision of an Aristotelian Middle Ages in philosophy. Klibanski in his mid-30s had already convened with the best scholars in the field. One needs only to mention Vazink, great philologist, who worked with him on the Timaeus of Plato, and Lothar Labowski. To achieve this series of editions and translations unanimously considered today as pioneering work. I turn now to more personal recollections. I first met him in the fall of 1964 when I was his student here in Montreal in a class on the medieval tradition of Platonic thought. I was registered at the Institute of Medieval Studies run by the Dominican fathers and now Alice extinct. And so is extinct the library that they held. It is now merge into the Greater Library of Human Science at Université de Montréal. This institute was a multidisciplinary program where we were offered an excellent training in Greek and Latin, as well as an introduction to the subtle techniques of critical edition. The librarian of the institute, Father Giguère, was himself a trained paleographer. He often discussed with Raymond Klibanski in class with us. And I had the privilege to work also with Father de Durand, a specialist of the Greek Church Fathers. The question now is, how did Klibanski join that Christian club? He was presented to us as a specialist of late Platonic thought. I had several seminars with him, all of them concerned with that theme. My decision to study later Greek thought was at that time almost definitive, but I owe him a final impulse. He persuaded me that the Neoplatonic tradition was a very fruitful subject on the topic that I had elected, that is free will. And following his advice, I embarked on a research on Plotinus and Proclus on free will. The first course I had with him was a series of readings on the Platonism of St. Augustine, the Confessions, the Academica, and of course, Civitas Dei. The second was a course devoted to the history of the Timaeus, from the translation of Chalcedius to the school of Chartres. His library is filled with superb editions of that Chesedius translation, some of them in the exhibition. It is only later that I discovered that he had written his habilitation dissertation in 1928 on Bernard and Thierry of Chartres, a text that he refers to in his 1939 book on the continuity of Platonic tradition at preserved, and that is until now unpublished. The third course that I had with him was an introduction to the Renaissance philosophy of science, from Nicholas of Cusa on the infinite and physics to Roger Bacon. This course attracted all the students who attended his evening meetings on history of science, in which, unfortunately, I myself never participated. I was full of prejudice, but on science. My good friend Raymond Fredet, some of them might know him, who was to become a famous Galileo scholar, was there, and so was Désiré, and told me of the importance of these meetings for the students and colleagues. In those meetings, Raymond created the Society for the History and Philosophy of Science that met at McGill regularly. In those days, the prestige of our master was enormous. They had less in common with any university professor today than went Hegel or Humboldt. All of them were European or schooled in Europe, which for us was a tremendous quality. It was like an aura. All of them, including Paul Ricoeur, a great friend of Raymond, who was guest professor in the Faculty of Philosophy in the University of Montreal, or Henri-Irénée Maroux from the Sorbonne, a famed petrologist, brought to us the ideal of European scholarship. But how can we define that? What is European scholarship? The main element was, of course, philological precision, scrutiny, and the love of books. Like all others, Klibanski always had a new book to announce, to promote. But when we met him in his office in Leacock Cisso 8, just across the street, he always laid his hand on his Nicholas of Cusa 1514 edition, now on show in the exhibition. This was like his most important book. This was like a sign of his very deep link, very profound, to the past. And this takes some kind of importance after what we had heard, we have heard this morning from our friends about the uniqueness of the book physically. We were students in an institute led by the Dominicans, but that was not a religious institute. The Christian tradition was, of course, of utmost importance, but we had also courses on medieval Jewish thought with a very clever rabbi, Dr. Kaim Dinberg, and also courses on Islamic thought, where I personally registered later for several years. This is an important point. Although Raymond was universally known in those years as a champion of tolerance, his edition of the Letter of John Locke had just been published in Paris, he was, as a teacher, a very enthusiastic advocate of transcultural studies. I mean by that he never missed an occasion of stressing the importance of studying the influences between the traditions. I remember one day when we were studying a text of Peter Abelard, Petrus Abelardus. He engaged into a long digression, like he loved to do, on the knowledge of Islamic thought in the Middle Ages, went on to comment on Peter the Venerable to make sure we did not confuse the two Peters, and then went on to remember his dear Ramon Llull, a thinker from Catalonia and a very interesting cross-border figure. This, you might wonder, I recall because I kept all my notebooks from his teaching. I knew they were important. I must say that I had no inkling during my studies of the importance of Klibanski as a world-class figure. He was, like all our other teachers, of which I have mentioned a few, a model of scholarship of excellency. We knew, of course, of Raymond Klibanski's personal library. How could we avoid looking at it when we were seated in his office? We were invited to sit In the small office, the one on the right, after crossing the threshold. Nothing could have given us a bigger pleasure than he being busy on the phone for a while or giving permission to wander in the numerous aisles of his library. But that never happened, at least not to me. But when asked about this or that topic, he would stand up and pick up some book for us to note and consider reading. As can be seen in the film of Anne-Marie Touga, who is being screened tonight, his larger table in the library, that is on the other part of his office, was covered with papers, letters, prospectus from publishers, antiquarian dealers, catalogs like the one that Christopher showed us this morning, from all over the world. He collected stamps, not for a personal collection, but to give to people interested, and would ask if we did too the same. Of course, he oftentimes referred to European libraries he had worked in, mainly the Bodleian, but also the Italian-German libraries, which he knew intimately. These libraries could not be compared with ours, but still the Dominicans of Saint Albert maintained a very good collection, and I have quite a few souvenirs of Raymond Klibanski working there, searching for some book in the big wooden a file container that was like a piece of furniture in the center of the main reading room. Some of us, like myself, had a key for the library, a personal desk on the second floor where we could chat over our work during evenings, even spend the night. And it happened that we met Klibanski discussing with some white-robed medievalist in the library after hours quite often. His scholarship was indeed awesome. His lectures were filled with his love of knowledge that he presented to us as a goal worthy of a lifelong devotion. He was, of course, himself the model of that philosopher, first and foremost a philomat described by Plato in the Republic. His teaching, and I will terminate on that, consisted in reading great texts slowly and with a special attention to their style and rhetorical figures. If in these texts, for example, Plato's Timaeus, if these texts were to convey meaning to us nowadays, in the present, we were asked by Klibanski to make an effort to experience them as if they were addressed to us that very morning in his voice. Needless to say, all his students loved him very dearly. He sat very quietly in front of us with his papers and books, and his speech was calm, nearly confidential. Father Lacroix, that several of you might know, Father Benoît Lacroix, age now 97, who was a dear friend of Klibanski, liked nothing more than to imitate Raymond's speech, his suave declamation. He does that on film. Last note, among his preferred topic, I would like to recall some major questions. Why is history able to produce good and evil at the same time? Why do religions seem unable to lead to peace? Why the claim of the unicity of truth seems incompatible with dialogue and tolerance? And most important, why the demands of philosophical reason for dialogue and respect are historically met with such poor results? These were the questions of this great scholar. Raymond Klibanski had found the expression of these questions in a work of Nicholas of Cusa on the Peace of Faith, De Pace Fidei, a work that was for him the center, the core of his intellectual endeavor. Why should we work towards knowledge if it is not to gain good and peace? My talk today is an homage to this great figure. Thank you.
Thank you, Professor Leroux. The second speaker is Gerald Beasley. Gerald Beasley has been head librarian of the Canadian Center for Architecture and the director of the Avery Architectural and Fine Arts Library in New York. He is now a university librarian at Concordia University. He will offer us his personal reflection on remembering Professor Klebanski as a bibliophile.
Merci. Thank you, Isabel. And you know, I have a feeling as we go through today, we circle around various themes, and I guess I knew we would, but I guess we're getting closer to them as the day wears on, and I feel very happy about that, and at the same time, I cherish them in a very special way because of my memories of Professor Klebanski. And at least two of the words that come to my mind are authenticity and emotion. And I think when we think about rare books and their relationship to the world today, those two words will increasingly come back to our minds, not because they are necessarily absent from the world outside a rare book collection, but because I truly believe that within the collection is where you find them in their most concentrated development. And I feel that as we are here celebrating the library of one of the truly great Montrealers that I had the privilege to meet, we have an opportunity to make something of this moment, and I'm very pleased to hear so many people work towards and around these themes. For me, I feel, rather in giving my talk, as if I'm attempting to carry a bowl that is brimful already successfully to the end of my presentation. And I do it because I feel rather as if I'm not so much remembering, as I will, my relatively few memories of Professor Klebanski, whom I met in, I think, 1998 or 1999, certainly towards the end of his long life. But I feel as well that I'm here to represent librarians, archivists, curators, historians of the book, bibliophiles, the people who I feel had a very natural and special connection with Professor Klebanski, even outside his own special domains, which themselves, as you are hearing, were so broad. And I feel that in representing them as best I can, I must do my best. And if I fail, I will fail as well as I possibly can. So thank you. And I do want to say one other thing before we start, perhaps, which is that I have no doubt at all that Professor Klebanski's collection is one of McGill's most important acquisitions, and I congratulate McGill on the collection. Many of his treasures are on display, of course, at present at the wonderful exhibition at the Grand Bibliothèque. Most of us, I hope, have seen the exhibition. Many of us in the room knew Professor Klebanski, and many of you knew him much better than I did. To use one of Professor Klebanski's own tropes, I would say nobody in this room is more than a couple of handshakes away from Professor Klebanski. So I hope that we will take advantage as well of just the togetherness that we have here to remember him. One of the reasons I think it's a great collection is because, at least for me, I'm going to call it a great Canadian collection. And I'm aware, of course, I am aware that a large number of the books in Professor Klebanski's collection are of European origin. And of course, they range from the 15th century to the 21st century. And with that time span, you can imagine it's very often the European materials that receive the focus. But if you go to the exhibition, you will be able to see a video interview with Professor Klebanski, in which he talks about his time that Professor Leroux mentioned as Privatdozent at Heidelberg University. And it seems clear to me, as again you said, Georges, that in many ways Professor Klebanski felt that the intellectual and spiritual heart of his work was there in Heidelberg. So now we have to think how shocking that must have been, that he would have to describe in a video interview 50 years later what he himself called the annihilation of the university, of the whole idea of a university, by Hitler's infamous questionnaire in April 1933, requiring university professors to inform the state about the religion of themselves and their ancestors. And it was, of course, the honest response to this questionnaire that also took Professor Klibanski away from Heidelberg, seeking safety in exile, and eventually finding a new home in Montreal. Do we ever accidentally fall into the belief that universities are impregnable, and that the rights and academic freedoms they enshrine are somehow beyond attack? If so, I think we make a mistake. And if nothing else, it seems to me that the events of the last year here in Montreal have given us a new perspective, if we care to examine them. One that Professor Klibanski would have understood very well, because he knew from personal experience that universities were far more fragile than we would like to believe. And in a way, one of the reasons I say it's a great Canadian collection is because Professor Klibanski's library stands as a testament to fragility and the possibility of surviving that fragility. The university, after all, is perhaps a safe harbor for people and books. That's how we think of it. But as Professor Klibanski knew, there is no such thing as a safe harbor unless we work actively to shore up the banks, to control the tides, to staff the lighthouses, to be ever watchful and ever on the lookout. I think Professor Klibanski knew very well, and the fact that his library came to McGill is, among other things no doubt, a tribute to his faith in Canada and Canadian universities to enshrine the values that he first found, I would expect, in Heidelberg. I very much like the fact that in the exhibition, one of the books that he owned is Vom Leben des Geistes der Universität und vom Studieren by Karl Jaspers and Fritz Ernst. So it's about the living spirit of the university, and it's written by two people who he would have known very well, and it's dated 1946, the year that he left. There's a second reason for my confidence that this is one of the most important collections in Montreal, and that's because, of course, we see the library not just as a collection of books, but as a way to connect or reconnect with their former owner. I met Professor Klibanski, as I said, in 1998, or perhaps 1999. I was introduced by Myra Nan Rosenfeld, Dr. Rosenfeld, with whom I was working at the Canadian Centre for Architecture at the time, on a proposed exhibition of Renaissance architectural books. I would like to just take a moment, if I may, to express my appreciation both to Professor Klibanski, but also to Madame Groffier, for the opportunity that those cinq cassettes gave people like me to come and encounter Professor Klibanski. I had no academic contact. I was not a student of Professor Klibanski. To be given that opportunity was a rare privilege and something that I will forever be grateful for. So I visited Professor Klibanski several times at his apartment. I had the honor also of receiving him at the Canadian Center for Architecture and showing him some of its treasures. I think I would have had more to say to this group if we had executed the plan we had of visiting Germany together to look at some of the early architectural manuscripts in Wolfenbüttel and elsewhere that Professor Klibanski had located. As it was, I went to New York, and at the time of Professor Klibanski's passing, I was at Columbia University. And I only returned to Montreal in 2008 to take up my current position at Concordia. So I want to give you some idea of what it's like to have known Professor Klibanski, and in particular to have known him surrounded by his books and by his friends and colleagues. And one of the things I note, actually, as I look, I see this rather wonderful image of Professor Klibanski in front of one of the larger books. It's a fine image, and it's not quite my recollection, in the sense that Professor Klibanski, it seemed to me, completed himself by holding a book. I don't know how else to say it. people do things in different ways, and that just seemed the most natural thing in the world when Professor Klibanski had a book and was able especially to show that book to somebody who he knew would appreciate the book as well. And that book could have been published in the last 6 months, and there would be a handwritten inscription from a former student or a fellow academic. Or it could have been equally well and handled with just the same amount of grace and care. It could have been a 15th century edition of Plato. There really was, in my mind at least, for my observation, there was an awareness, an appreciation, but not a discrimination in terms of the importance of print. And when we talk about authority, as I think we started to do this morning, I think talking about the authority and the authenticity, as I would say, of print, we get to the heart of one of the ideas of a library that would have been held by Professor Klibanski very passionately and very meaningfully and over such a long time that, as I say, it just seemed like he was investing books rather than reading them. It was a wonderful thing to see, and I felt very privileged to be part of a group, a small group of people, where Professor Klibanski would show us material. He would delight in the material. His eyes would light up. The books were there. The great thing, one of the great things about having a library intact passed to a university, is that it gives us some opportunity to extend that grace and privilege that we had when the owner was alive. And that, for me, is the other aspect that I would say confirms me in the knowledge that McGill has one of the great, great collections by accepting Professor Klibanski's library into McGill University. What we used to talk about, well, we used to talk about architecture. I know Professor Klibanski's interests have been listed, and by now you're probably losing count as 8, 9, 10. He was interested in architecture and architectural history as well. And another point of contact and correspondence between us actually became the manuscript edition of the Roman architect Vitruvius, but also, especially because it was connected to the study of Nicholas of Cusa. Nicholas of Cusa, who wrote a treatise on weights and weight scales, which was appended to certain editions of Vitruvius in the 16th century. 1543 Strasbourg edition can be seen in the exhibition, for example. But also, I think, to the broader humanist tradition that brought architecture from the single surviving Roman treatise of Vitruvius into the early and later Renaissance period, had a great interest for Professor Klibanski. And Nicholas of Cusa, he had identified the handwriting of Nicholas of Cusa in one of the early Vitruvian manuscripts. So now, there is so much that I feel, well, I wish I had had longer conversations. I wish I had had the privilege of longer times with Professor Klibanski. I went to the exhibition and I realized there, only for the first time, I'm afraid, that he was indeed, as Georges mentioned, the editor of Charles de Beauvel's Liber de Sapiente. De Beauvel, you may not know, was a pupil of Jacques Lefebvre d'Etaples. Well, the CCA owns a very rare 1516 edition of Euclid, edited by Jacques Lefebvre d'Etaples, bound with a 1511 edition of Vitruvius, with contemporary marginal annotations that indicate the text was circulating amongst a northern humanist circle in the early 16th century. Bound in the same volume is the 1525 edition of Albrecht Dürer's Unterweisung der Messen. And so we arrive at a point where, in a way, we know that Professor Klibanski will be interested. Albrecht Dürer, after all, the artist behind the great engraving Melancholia, and in many ways, I think, one of the touchstones. And I didn't know that connection, and I was unable to make it. And here I am now, being given the great privilege, because the library has been preserved, of being able to just mention it and pass it on and think about it. Well, of course, you know, there is a limit to what we can do, but the things we are doing with this collection and the things McGill is doing, I think, are so important. And they're important for the future of librarianship, and I hope they're important for the people that I have tried in a very minor way to represent, the librarians, the curators, the archivists, the people who care for the same things that Professor Klebanski cared for. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Musli. Our third speaker is Professor Desiree Park. She's a former student and a former research assistant of Professor Raymond Klebanski. She's now emeritus professor in philosophy at Concordia University. She will speak to us about her memories of Professor Klebanski.
About an hour ago, I confirmed with Georges Leroux that we were both students of Professor Klebanski, and we overlapped. That also gives an idea of Klebanski's activities in Montreal. I was a student at McGill. Georges was a student at the Université de Montréal. At least some of the years, we overlapped. Today, I will be talking about remembering Professor Klebanski. And I've tried to attach him to his books, that is, the books he traveled around with. And he did travel around with his books quite a lot. His offices changed, his residences changed, and the books kept with him, and he was not ever without them, one way or another. In September 1961, Raymond Klebanski appeared in the staff seminar of the philosophy department of McGill University, fresh from a sabbatical year. At the time, I knew that Professor Klebanski was a major scholar and philosopher, but I did not know that he was a humanitarian of the First Order, nor that he was an inspiring teacher, a wise mentor, and eventually he became a neighbor and friend. For the record, that September, I was an MA student recently arrived at McGill. One way to depict Raymond Klebanski, or as the students referred to him, Klib, obviously he was never addressed this way, is to trace the travels of his library as it migrated around the McGill campus. There was first his office and library in Duggan House, at the corner of McTavish Street and Pine Avenue. There he had a beautiful view of the city and mountain and even the St. Lawrence River on a good day. There, too, he permitted me to read some of his rare books, in particular works of the Cambridge Platonists, because I was writing a thesis on the philosophy of George Berkeley, who was influenced by them. It was important for the Cambridge Platonists to be an influence on Berkeley, because Berkeley, as an Anglican, was avoiding St. Thomas Aquinas. This was a great privilege that I was given to read these books. Of course, they never left his office, so it was rather sociable, too. Judy Ogilvie was his secretary, and Klebanski and I would have coffee. They would go on with their work, and I would read some more of the Cambridge Platonists. It was a very nice time. Later, when I became a research assistant, the Duggan House office was the scene of work on the Corpus Platonicum, including the Timaeus, as well as the collection that Klebanski edited, Philosophy in the Mid-Century, and the first edition of Saturn and Melancholy, published in 1964. There, too, Klebanski worked on the Latin text and translations of John Locke's Epistola de Tolerantia. Subsequently, there were many translations of Locke's letter, including English, French, Italian, and most European languages, plus Hebrew, Arabic, Japanese, and so on. When the Leacock building was completed, Raymond Klebanski and his library migrated down McTavish Street and arrived in a splendid office overlooking the reservoir and the mountain. This office included a large second room with a seminar table, which allowed Klebanski to give a class surrounded by a good many of the books that provided references for the subject in question. And so, on the 3rd of October, 1966, he began a series of lectures on the Platonic tradition. This class attracted not only graduate students from McGill, but also from the Université de Montréal, and I believe several former students, including myself. At the time, I was already teaching at Loyola College, which was then part of the University of Montreal. True to Klebanski's approach, we were given a clear and indeed fascinating account of some relevant pre-Socratic thought to show, of course, how Plato came to pose some of his particular questions. The letters of Plato were discussed, as was Plato's Timaeus and Parmenides, and subsequent interpretations were presented, including some by Philo Judaeus, or Philo of Alexandria, St. Augustine, St. Thomas Aquinas, to name only a few. It was a full course, so there were a good many. I mentioned this technique of presentation, that is, the people prior to Plato, because it points up Klebanski's approach to the history of philosophy, and one I came to appreciate. That is, the study of the history of philosophy is not a collection and recitation of supposed facts, but a consideration of selected philosophical questions in chronological order. And the chronology is important, because we tend to read history backwards and therefore overlook the values and perspectives of the actors in their own time. At McGill, Klebanski also gave, for many years, a course in medieval philosophy that was very popular with students from other disciplines, students in the sciences, music, other liberal arts subject, as well as philosophy, were intrigued by the richness of the subject. Like all gifted lecturers, Klebanski left the students with a determination to run to the main library to find the books he mentioned before anyone else got to them. This was, of course, a time well before electronic copies, and often the library had only one copy, or if you were lucky, two copies. The Leacock office saw the continued production of Locke's letter in yet more translations. During this time, too, the four volumes of contemporary philosophy were produced. The usual problems of organizing contributors to any one book were accentuated by the many languages of those writing. On one occasion, Klebanski's patience and care as the editor of contemporary philosophy were well illustrated. In my role of research assistant, I recall spending an entire morning in his office trying to understand what one contributor could possibly have meant by what appeared on the page. It was a curious exercise in noticing that strings of properly spelled words in grammatical order need not mean anything. Finally, after some hours, Klebanski drafted a polite letter to the contributor asking for the original text, which could easily be translated here, of course. As far as I know, no one's feelings were hurt, and Klebanski got the text eventually. Klebanski's reputation as a lecturer and teacher was well known. From a quite different quarter, I early had evidence of this. Working on my MA thesis on George Berkeley, I found a disagreement in a key translation, one by A.A. Luce and one by Thomas Jefferson, who were the editors of Berkeley's collected works in 9 volumes. I preferred the Jessup version, and Klebanski advised me to write to Jessup to ask why he chose it. Greatly daring, I mentioned that Klebanski had advised this. I was very much in awe of Jessup, as any Berkeley scholar would be. And Jessup duly replied very fully and kindly and congratulated me on my good fortune in having Klebanski as my teacher. Apropos of Klebanski and libraries, there was an occasion some years later when he wanted an early edition of Locke's letter on toleration checked as to its publication date. At the time, I was in the Netherlands, so he asked me to look at the copy at the University of Leiden Library in the Netherlands. I duly went to the library and looked up the Locke reference. It was all right. That was what he wanted to know. While there, just out of curiosity, I decided to look up Klebanski's works. The library card, we were still using paper, written, quote, Klebanski, comma, Raymond, unquote, carried the message, quote, Seja Klebanski, Remundus, unquote. Sure enough, His first publication on Carolus Bovillus in 1927 was listed, and I suppose he's still listed in his Latin version of his name. In any case, the scrupulous recording of the Latin version gave me yet another reason to appreciate the precision of Dutch librarians. As a humanitarian, Klebanski, of course, was well known. When I was his research assistant, I knew about his correspondence concerning the Institut International de Philosophie, or if you prefer, the International Institute of Philosophy, whose main office was in Paris. In the course of typing some letters to the Paris office, I also knew that Klebanski made use of the fact that he was at the time president of the IIP, and that he exercised his influence on behalf of scholars who were out of favor with their totalitarian governments. There was the case of Leszek Kolakowski, who had offended the Polish government. Klebanski's proposal was to invite Kolakowski to McGill as a visiting professor. This was accepted by the powers in Poland, but they said that Madame Kolakowska and their daughter must remain in Poland. Klebanski replied that this condition was quite unreasonable, contrary to all McGill traditions, and so on. In effect, Klebanski and the IIP had spoken. And since the powers in Poland wished to appear reasonable to the world, they gave in. The result was that Professor Kolakowski and his wife and daughter arrived in Montreal and continued to live in the West. Later, the Kolakowskis lived in Oxford, and after the Polish government changed, he again lectured in Poland. In February 1977, the Charter 77 event organized by Klebanski included a protest presented to the Czechoslovak consulate here in Montreal. It concerned the arrest of the Czech philosopher Jan Potocka. And Klebanski's idea was that all four universities in Montreal should be represented in the delegation. To this end, La Traverse represented the Université du Québec à Montréal, Vianney Descaries, the Université de Montréal. From McGill, there were Raymond Klebanski, Alistair MacKinnon, and Charles Taylor, and I represented Concordia. The petition was handed in after a study delay by the rather aggressive minions at the consulate, and then we all went away. At the time, it was well known that the Czech government played rough, and they played very rough indeed, because soon afterwards, Potocka died under questioning. A light touch, however, also about that encounter might be found if one could dig up the archives of the then secret police. Because as I recall, at the time, Charles Taylor and I openly speculated about the likely location of the hidden camera that was no doubt recording it all. At Wolfson College, there's another phase of Klebanski's life after he had retired from McGill. Now, of course, a part of Klebanski's library was moved to Wolfson College in Oxford in 1981 when he was elected a fellow of the college. Once again, Klebanski's gifts as a teacher were evident in his generous discussions with the students he encountered. Although he did not give any classes, his experience and broad sympathies made him especially valuable to the college admissions committee, notably for the students in science. On a simple note, human note, he often would seek out a lone student in the dining hall and begin a conversation in the student's own native language. Living in college, Raymond Klebanski also kept a benevolent eye on the non-human population, namely on the ducks and swans that lived in the Wolfson Harbor, which was a sheltered part of the river by which the river Isis, and which Wolfson College stands on the banks of. Of which Wolfson College stands on the banks, get that one right. When the resident pair of swans nested, in due course, Klebanski would report in letters the number of newly hatched cygnets, occasionally noting rather sadly that another one had disappeared. In any event, both ducks and swans were well fed from his flat in Wolfson. When Raymond Klebanski was well in his 90s, the humanitarian aspect of his character continued to flourish. The fact is that he thought it his duty to help those oppressed by tyrannical governments, and a lively correspondence to this end was a feature of his days. In the Bodleian Library, the Taylor Institution Library, and at Wolfson, he also combined his love of learning with a very sociable personality and enjoyed great popularity. Finally, and now viewed altogether, we can, I hope, see that Raymond Klebanski did not fail to use his talents to enlighten and his influence to do good. Thank you. Very good.
Thank you very much. So now we have a period of question, and if you have a question, go to the microphone, please.
I don't have a question, but I actually just wanted to say how much I enjoyed listening to these reminiscences of Professor Klebanski. I'm Professor Sarah Stroud. I'm from the Department of Philosophy here at McGill. And I arrived here in 1993, so in some very extended sense, I've been a colleague of Professor Klebanski. I hardly ever spoke with him. I'm sure most of the people in this room perhaps knew him better than I did. But I just wanted to add what a revered and adored figure he was in the department, and it's just delightful for me to hear this fuller portrait of him emerge. So I actually just wanted to thank Richard, Dean Cook, the organizing team for having this celebration of Professor Klebanski today, and I might add the department's also delighted about the incredible range of activities around Professor Klebanski at the Kahn Bibliothek this whole year. Thank you for bringing this very personal dimension to someone that it would have been such a shame to celebrate without talking about the very personal dimensions. So thank you.
Thank you very much, everyone, for the very moving testimonials and memories. I very much appreciated that. My own meeting with Dr. Klebanski was limited to one exchange when I was an undergraduate student, and he said one thing to me which has stuck with me forever. And it was a very simple conversation, and he just said to me, "What are you reading?" And when I told him, he said, "Who's the author?" And then he said, "It's very, very important to know the author." And I was and that sentence has lived with me forever. And I just would like to ask Gerald a question, actually, from as one librarian to another, in a follow-up on what you said in your very moving talk. You talked about the importance of authenticity. And I was intrigued by that. And I wonder if you could maybe expand on that a little bit, please.
I'm happy to do so. Excuse me, I'll just get the microphone a little forward. Can everybody hear me clearly enough? Thank you. Thank you, Chris, for that question. I think authenticity is probably one of the great challenges that we face as a library profession in the 21st century. And when I talk about holding a bowl brimful at the beginning of a conversation, of course, I'm talking about the talk. But I'm also talking about, I think, the responsibilities that we have as curators of collections, which go well beyond what we've all been somewhat overawed by, which is the power of the internet to provide access. So access no longer seems to be quite the problem that it used to be. It has problematic aspects, but it's not the great challenge that it would have been when Professor Klebanski began his career. Now, when he began his career, finding a collection that would allow you to study some of the medievalists that he was interested in would have actually defined your location in a way that that doesn't have to happen anymore. But if we think about authenticity and we go a little bit beyond the sense of, you know, well, you know, it's something that I got off the internet or it's something that I got through a digital resource, we arrive back, I think, very quickly at the accidental power of paper, the accidental power of the physical object to convey an authenticity which simply cannot exist in a digital realm. Just imagine for a moment Professor Klibanski leaving Heidelberg in April 1933 with what he calls a diplomatic passport for a precious but small collection of books, which is what he took with him. Imagine a diplomatic passport that would actually allow you to exit a country with a collection of books that you knew those texts would not change, those images were stable, whatever you had in your hands, that was them. That's going to be gone from any world where we translate that. Imagine leaving Germany with an iPad. Well, what will that mean? You know, I mean, I'm sure most of you know the digital materials that we use, and valuably, you know, they provide huge additional functionality. Typically, they're licensed by the libraries, right? Well, I mean, if you've been reading things, you will know that those licenses are to materials that can change like that for a commercial reason. So what was delivered under one title one day can be another thing when it is delivered under the same title the next day. Of course, this happens more with commercial than academic work. But when I talk about authenticity, I think that we look again and again to the rare book collection to supply the library with the kind of authenticity which you won't find outside as clearly or as clearly developed. And I think the curatorial skills, genius, I think sometimes, that goes into caring for those is a recognition of authenticity within that space. And I think historians recognize it increasingly as the way to get to something that has an irreplaceable and irreducible truth associated with it. That's my feeling. There may be others who want to comment. Thank you.
One of the intriguing things that came out of Julian Tom's dissertation were the number of books in the Klibanski collection, which came from Quebec collections, from seminaries, Collège Classique, and presumably this was tied up with the major changes which occurred in the 1960s, the secularization of Quebec society, the collapse of the Collège Classique in favor of Sejefs. And I'm wondering what you draw from this. Did he quite purposely set out to try to retrieve these books, because he knew that there was a problem? The way in which so much of Quebec's religious and classical heritage just disappeared so quickly. Was he simply taking advantage of a situation that material was now becoming available, or did he feel that he did have an obligation to try to save part of this classical heritage which is now encompassed in his collection?
Well, maybe we should ask Jillian about this, because even the task of identifying those books in the collection is difficult. Jillian, why don't you come here and okay, and answer that question. Were you there when he put the question?
Yeah, okay. I have the question. And I can't answer it fully, but there is something else in the collection that does give me some ideas about that. But it's one of the many questions I would so much have loved to have put to him about his peers, and I didn't ever get the chance to speak with him about his library. But one of the aspects that was very interesting in his library was this development after he left Germany, this is tangential, but you'll understand where I'm going with this. After he left Germany, he continued to collect in the authors and his mentors and their mentors from the Weimar Republic. So there's this beautiful kind of what I have referred to as sort of a monument to his Weimar experience. And it looks in, from looking at the library, it looks like the idea of recovery, of preservation, about protection of these traditions was very much part of his, whether it was a conscious acquisition plan, who knows, but he was doing it all the time. And so my impression is, given the evidence seen in the collection, he has a whole bunch of books that were being deaccessioned by British institutional libraries during the Second World War period that were in German, you know, and so he's collecting all these things. And some of them are from really key provenance collections of those institutions. And so my impression is that if, as Dr. Ver, I think, has surmised, that these books that were being deaccessioned or thrown away in some cases, for example, from the Archevêché de Montréal, that they were being, when he saw these at auction, because some of them were preserved, I believe that the fact that they were from the Archevêché de Montréal would have been significant to him. He would have been interested not only in the texts, but in the fact that it was the Quebec clergy that had been using and studying these texts and engaging with them. Some of them are annotated by an archbishop, we think. So I do think that probably that was, could have been part of a concerted effort at preservation in times of trouble and ideological change that bring about devastation and sort of collateral damage in libraries.
Thank you. Do we have another question?
In fact, it's not really a question, but it's a follow-up about what Mr. Beasley said on the relationship that Raymond Klibanski had with books. In the 80s, I was teaching in the Faculty of Law in this university, and I had a sabbatical. I was staying in Canada because I was studying terminology in common law and civil law, and Canada was the place to do that. And I had a little bit of time in my hand, and I wanted to widen my horizons. And I happened to read in the McGill Reporter an article on Klibanski. And I said, well, this is the person I must meet. So I wrote him a fan letter. And he invited me to his office, and I discovered that he was writing at that time an article entitled Hidden Treasures at McGill. Hidden treasures were the documents and the manuscript in the rare book departments, which were not very well known, or not known at all. And in a bold movement, I suggested that maybe I could help him. I mind, of course, I thought of carrying boxes and handing books and that sort of thing. And he said, yes, why not? Why don't you accompany me to the underworld? In those days, rare books were in the basement, you see. Now, in French, he would say, les bas-fonds, but that's not very nice. And so I followed him to the basement, and that was for me a revelation. You see, I was not an art historian, not a philosopher, not a historian. To Klibanski, I must have been a barbarian. But, and this is his pedagogy, he wouldn't touch a book without explaining to me what it was all about. He showed me all the documents. There were those boxes full of marvelous illuminated indulgences of Pope of the 15th century and things like that. And what happened was that my world became populated. You see, I had learned at school about Descartes and Plato and all that, but there were people I knew nothing about. And I thought, maybe because I studied a long, long time ago, that between the fall and the Roman Empire and the Renaissance, there wasn't much. You see, there was Charlemagne, yes, the Crusades. I was in a school without God, so the Crusades were a bad thing. And thanks to Klibanski, I discovered that there were people, extraordinary people. I read John of Salisbury, and he is one of the most fascinating authors, 12th century, I've ever read. There was Giordano Bruno. There was Agrippa von Lettenstein, a magician, professor of university, that's not always the same thing, and a physician and a feminist. Fascinating. But what struck me was that Raymond Klibanski had with books a very special relationship. And when I read later on the Philobiblon by Richard de Bury, Bishop of Durham, 14th century, he wrote a book called The Love of Books. And he said, in books, I find the dead as if they were living. And for Klibanski, Nicholas of Cus, Plato, David Hume were sitting there next to him, you see. They were friends. Klibanski worried about the fall of Constantinople or any other political event of the time because it worried them. They were there. And that what made him also a reader. Thank you.
We have time for another question, if there is some. Well, I guess we will thank again our speakers. Thank you.
I will perhaps just demystify the image behind us with one last personal anecdote on Dr. Klibanski and a book. This happens to be the Nuremberg Chronicle. This is the copy that was hand-colored and resides in the Osler Library. And only Dr. Klibanski was able to know about McGill's three copies of the Nuremberg Chronicle, one of which, this hand-colored copy, and to which he introduced me some years ago, and for which I'm very grateful. And now we'll take a very short break until 3:45, and we'll have you back for our last panel. Thank you.
Merci, Isabel. Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.